more often than not because she was a hopeless case. And he still wished that he could go back home to Berlin, although the memories of that place were beginning to fade, and while he did mean to, it had been several weeks since he'd even thought about sending another letter to grandfather or grandmother, let alone actually sitting down and writing one. The soldiers still came and went every day of the week, holding meetings in father's office, which was still out of bounds at all times and no exceptions. Lieutenant Kotler still strode around in his black boots, as if there was no one in the whole world of any more importance than him. And when he wasn't with father, he was standing in the driveway talking to Gretel, while she laughed hysterically and twirled her hair around her fingers, or whispering alone in rooms with mother. The servants still came and washed things and swept things and cooked things and cleaned things and served things and took things away and kept their mouths shut unless they were spoken to. Maria still spent most of her time tidying things away and making sure that any item of clothing not currently being worn by Bruno was neatly folded in his wardrobe. And Pavel still arrived at the house every afternoon to peel the potatoes and the carrots and then put his white jacket on and serve at the dinner table. From time to time, Bruno saw him throw a glance in the direction of his knee, where a tiny scar from his swing-related accident was in evidence. But other than that, they never spoke to each other. But then things changed. Father decided it was time for the children to return to their studies, and although it seemed ridiculous to Bruno that school should take place when there were only two students to teach, both mother and father agreed that a tutor should come to the house every day and fill their mornings and afternoons with lessons. A few mornings later, a man called Herr List rattled up the driveway on his bone shaker, and it was time for school again. Herr List was a mystery to Bruno. Although he was friendly enough most of the time, never raising his hand to him like his old teacher in Berlin had done, something in his eyes made Bruno feel there was an anger inside him just waiting to get out. Herr List was particularly fond of history and geography, while Bruno preferred reading and art. "Those things are useless to you," insisted the teacher. "A sound understanding of the social sciences is far more important in this day and age." "Grandmother always let us perform in plays back in Berlin," Bruno pointed out. "Your grandmother was not your teacher, though, was she?" asked Herr List. "She was your grandmother. And here I am your teacher, so you will study the things that I say are important, and not just the things you like yourself."
"But aren't books important?" asked Bruno.
"Books about things that matter in the world, of course," explained Herr List, "but not storybooks, not books about things that never happened. How much do you know of your history anyway, young man?" To his credit, Herr List referred to Bruno as young man, like Pavel and unlike Lieutenant Kotler.
"Well, I know I was born on April the 15th, 1934, said Bruno.
"Not your history," interrupted Herr List, "not your own personal history. I mean the history of who you are, where you come from, your family's heritage, the fatherland."
Bruno frowned and considered it. He wasn't entirely sure that father had any land, because although the house in Berlin was a large and comfortable house, there wasn't very much garden space around it, and he was old enough to know that Outwith did not belong to them, despite all the land there.
"Not very much," he admitted finally, "although I know quite a bit about the Middle Ages. I like stories about knights and adventures and exploring."
Herr List made a hissing sound through his teeth and shook his head angrily.
"Then this is what I am here to change," he said in a sinister voice. "To get your head out of your storybooks and teach you more about where you come from, about the great wrongs that have been done to you."
Bruno nodded and felt quite pleased by this, as he assumed that he would finally be given an explanation for why they'd all been forced to leave their comfortable home and come to this terrible place, which must have been the greatest wrong ever committed to him in his short life. Sitting alone in his room a few days later, Bruno started thinking about all the things he liked to do at home that he hadn't been able to do since he'd come to Outwith. Most of them came about because he no longer had any friends to play with, and it wasn't as if Gretel would ever play with him. But there was one thing that he was able to do on his own, and that he had done all the time back in Berlin, and that was exploring. "When I was a child," Bruno said to himself, "I used to enjoy exploring, and that was in Berlin, where I knew everywhere and could find anything I wanted with a blindfold on. I've never really done any exploring here.
Perhaps it's time to start. And then, before he could change his mind, Bruno jumped off his bed and rummaged in his wardrobe for an overcoat and an old pair of boots, the kind of clothes he thought a real explorer might wear, and prepared to leave the house. There was no point doing any exploring inside. After all, this wasn't like the house in Berlin, which he could just about remember had hundreds of nooks and crannies and strange little rooms, not to mention five floors, if you counted the basement and the little room at the top with the window he needed to stand on tiptoes to see through. No, this was a terrible house for exploration. If there was any to be done, it would have to be done outside. For months now, Bruno had been looking out of his bedroom window at the garden and the bench with the plaque on it, the tall fence and the wooden telegraph poles and all the other things he'd written to Grandmother about in his most recent letter. And as often as he had watched the people, all the different kinds of people in their striped pajamas, it had never really occurred to him to wonder what it was all about. It was as if it were another city entirely, the people all living and working together side by side with the house where he lived. And were they really so different? All the people in the camp wore the same clothes, those pajamas and their striped cloth caps too, and all the people who wandered through his house, with the exception of Mother, Gretel and him, wore uniforms of varying quality and decoration and caps and helmets with bright red and black armbands and carried guns and always looked terribly stern, as if it was all very important, really, and no one should think otherwise. What exactly was the difference, he wondered to himself? And who decided which people wore the striped pajamas and which people wore the uniforms? Of course, sometimes the two groups mixed. He'd often seen the people from his side of the fence on the other side of the fence, and when he watched, it was clear that they were in charge. The pajama people all jumped to attention whenever the soldiers approached, and sometimes they fell to the ground, and sometimes they didn't even get up and had to be carried away instead. It's funny that I've never wondered about those people, Bruno thought, and it's funny that when you think of all the times the soldiers go over there, and he had even seen Father go over there on many occasions, that none of them had ever been invited back to the house. Sometimes, not very often, but sometimes, a few of the soldiers stayed to dinner. And when they did, a lot of frothy drinks were served, and the moment Gretel and Bruno had put the last forkful of food in their mouths, they were sent away to their rooms, and then there was a lot of noise downstairs, and some terrible singing, too. Father and Mother obviously enjoyed the company of the soldiers, Bruno could tell that, but they'd never once invited any of the striped pajama people to dinner. Leaving the house, Bruno went round the back and looked up towards his own bedroom window, which from down here did not look quite so high anymore. You could probably jump out of it and not do too much damage to yourself, he considered, although he couldn't imagine the circumstances in which he would try such an idiotic thing. Perhaps if the house were on fire and he was trapped in there, but even then it would seem risky. He looked as far to his right as he could see, and the tall fence seemed to carry on in the sunlight. And he was glad that it did, because it meant that he didn't know what was up ahead, and he could walk and find out. And that was what exploration was all about, after all. There was one good thing that Herr Lister taught him about in their history lessons. Men like Christopher Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci, men with such adventurous stories and interesting lives, that it only confirmed in Bruno's mind that he wanted to be like them when he grew up. Before heading off in that direction, though, there was one final thing to investigate. And that was the bench. All these months he'd been looking at it and staring at the plaque from a distance and calling it the bench with the plaque. But he still had no idea what it said. Looking left and right to make sure that no one was coming, he ran over to it and squinted as he read the words. It was only a small bronze plaque, and Bruno read it quietly to himself. Presented on the occasion of the opening of... He hesitated. Out with Camp, he continued, stumbling over the name as usual. June 1940. He reached out and touched it for a moment, and the bronze was very cold, so he pulled his fingers away before taking a deep breath and beginning his journey. The one thing Bruno tried not to think about was that he'd been told on countless occasions by both Mother and Father that he was not allowed to walk in this direction,
that he was not allowed anywhere near the fence or the camp, and, most particularly, that exploration was banned at Outwith, with no exceptions. Chapter 10. The dot that became a speck, that became a blob, that became a figure, that became a boy. The walk along the fence took Bruno a lot longer than he expected. It seemed to stretch on and on for several miles. He walked and walked, and when he looked back, the house that he was living in became smaller and smaller until it vanished from sight altogether. During all this time, he never saw anyone anywhere close to the fence, nor did he find any doors to let him inside, and he started to despair that his exploration was going to be entirely unsuccessful. In fact, although the fence continued as far as the eye could see, the huts and buildings and smokestacks were disappearing in the distance behind him, and the fence seemed to be separating him from nothing but open space. After walking for the best part of an hour, and starting to feel a little hungry, he thought that maybe that was enough exploration for one day, and it would be a good idea to turn back. However, just at that moment, a small dot appeared in the distance, and he narrowed his eyes to try to see what it was. Bruno remembered a book he had read in which a man was lost in the desert, and because he hadn't had any food or water for several days, had started to imagine that he saw wonderful restaurants and enormous fountains. But when he tried to eat or drink from them, they disappeared into nothingness, just handfuls of sand. He wondered whether that was what was happening to him now. But while he was thinking this, his feet were taking him step by step, closer and closer to the dot in the distance, which in the meantime had become a speck, and then began to show every sign of turning into a blob. And shortly after that, the blob became a figure. And then as Bruno got even closer, he saw that the thing was neither a dot nor a speck, nor a blob, nor a figure, but a person. In fact, it was a boy. Bruno had read enough books about explorers to know that one could never be sure what one was going to find. Most of the time they came across something interesting that was just sitting there, minding its own business, waiting to be discovered, such as America. Other times they discovered something that was probably best left alone, like a dead mouse at the back of a cupboard. The boy belonged to the first category. He was just sitting there, minding his own business, waiting to be discovered. Bruno slowed down when he saw the dot that became a speck, that became a blob, that became a figure, that became a boy. Although there was a fence separating them, he knew that you could never be too careful with strangers, and it was always best to approach them with caution. So he continued to walk, and before long they were facing each other. "Hello?" said Bruno. "Hello," said the boy. The boy was smaller than Bruno and was sitting on the ground with a forlorn expression. He wore the same striped pajamas that all the other people on that side of the fence wore and a striped cloth cap on his head. He wasn't wearing any shoes or socks and his feet were rather dirty. On his arm, he wore an armband with a star on it. When Bruno first approached the boy, he was sitting cross-legged on the ground, staring at the dust beneath him. However, after a moment he looked up and Bruno saw his face. It was quite a strange face, too. His skin was almost the colour of grey, but not quite like any grey that Bruno had ever seen before. He had very large eyes, and they were the colour of caramel sweets. The whites were very white, and when the boy looked at him, all Bruno could see was an enormous pair of sad eyes staring back. Bruno was sure that he'd never seen a skinnier or sadder boy in his life, but decided that he had better talk to him.
"I've been exploring," he said.
"Have you?" said the little boy.
"Yes, for almost 2 hours now."
This was not strictly speaking true. Bruno had been exploring for just over an hour, but he didn't think that exaggerating slightly would be too bad a thing to do. It wasn't quite the same thing as lying, and made him seem more adventurous than he really was.
"Have you found anything?" asked the boy.
"Very little."
"Nothing at all?"
"Well, I found you," said Bruno after a moment.
He stared at the boy and considered asking him why he looked so sad, but hesitated because he thought it might sound rude. He knew that sometimes people who were sad didn't want to be asked about it. Sometimes they'd offer the information themselves, and sometimes they wouldn't stop talking about it for months on end. But on this occasion, Bruno thought that he should wait before saying anything. He had discovered something during his exploration, and now that he was finally talking to one of the people on the other side of the fence, it seemed like a good idea to make the most of the opportunity. He sat down on the ground on his side of the fence and crossed his legs like the little boy and wished that he had brought some chocolate with him, or perhaps a pastry that they could share. "I live in the house on this side of the fence," said Bruno.
"Do you?"
"I saw the house once from a distance, but I didn't see you." "My room's on the first floor," said Bruno. "I can see right over the fence from there. I'm Bruno, by the way."
"I'm Shmuel," said the little boy.
Bruno scrunched up his face, not sure that he'd heard the little boy right.
"What did you say your name was?" he asked.
"Shmuel," said the little boy, as if it was the most natural thing in the world.
"What did you say your name was?"
"Bruno," said Bruno.
"I've never heard of that name," said Shmuel.
"And I've never heard of your name," said Bruno.
"Shmuel,"
he thought about it.
"Shmuel," he repeated.
"I like the way it sounds when I say it.
Shmuel.
It sounds like the wind blowing."
"Bruno," said Shmuel, nodding his head happily. "Yes, I think I like your name too. It sounds like someone who's rubbing their arms to keep warm."
"I've never met anyone called Shmuel before," said Bruno.
"There are dozens of Shmuels on this side of the fence," said the little boy.
"Hundreds, probably. I wish I had a name all of my own."
"I've never met anyone called Bruno," said Bruno, "other than me, of course. I think I might be the only one."
"Then you're lucky," said Shmuel.
"I suppose I am." "How old are you?" he asked.
Shmuel thought about it and looked down at his fingers, and they wiggled in the air as if he was trying to calculate.
"I'm 9, he said. "My birthday is April the 15th, 1934.
Bruno stared at him in surprise.
"What did you say?" he asked. "I said my birthday is April the 15th, 1934.
Bruno's eyes opened wide, and his mouth made the shape of an O.
"I don't believe it," he said.
"Why not?" asked Shmuel.
"No," said Bruno, shaking his head quickly. "I don't mean I don't believe you. I mean, I'm surprised, that's all, because my birthday is April the 15th too, and I was born in 1934. We were born on the same day."
Shmuel thought about this.
"So you're 9 too," he said.
"Isn't that strange?"
"Very strange," said Shmuel,
"because there may be dozens of Shmuels on this side of the fence, but I don't think that I've ever met anyone with the same birthday as me before."
"We're like twins," said Bruno.
"A little bit," agreed Shmuel.
Bruno felt very happy all of a sudden. A picture came into his head of Carl and Daniel and Martin, his 3 best friends for life, and he remembered how much fun they used to have together back in Berlin, and he realized how lonely he had been at Outwith.
"Do you have many friends?"
asked Bruno, cocking his head a little to the side as he waited for an answer.
"Oh, yes," said Shmuel. "Well, sort of."
Bruno frowned. He had hoped that Shmuel might have said no, as it would give them something else in common.
"Close friends?" he asked.
"Well, not very close," said Shmuel.
"But there are a lot of us, boys our age, I mean, on this side of the fence. We fight a lot of the time, though. That's why I come out here, to be on my own."
"It's so unfair," said Bruno. "I don't see why I have to be stuck over here, on this side of the fence, where there's no one to talk to and no one to play with, and you get to have dozens of friends and are probably playing for hours every day. I'll have to speak to Father about it."
"Where did you come from?"
asked Shmuel, narrowing his eyes and looking at Bruno curiously. "Berlin."
"Where's that?"
Bruno opened his mouth to answer, but found that he wasn't entirely sure.
"It's in Germany, of course," he said. "Don't you come from Germany?"
"No, I'm from Poland," said Shmuel.
Bruno frowned.
"Then why do you speak German?" he asked.
"Because you said hello in German, so I answered in German. Can you speak Polish?"
"No," said Bruno, laughing nervously. "I don't know anyone who can speak two languages, and especially no one of our age."
"Mama is a teacher in my school, and she taught me German," explained Shmuel.
"She speaks French, too, and Italian, and English. She's very clever."
"I don't speak French or Italian yet, but she said she'd teach me English one day because I might need to know it."
"Poland," said Bruno thoughtfully, weighing up the word on his tongue.
"That's not as good as Germany, is it?"
Shmuel frowned.
"Why isn't it?" he asked.
"Well, because Germany is the greatest of all countries," Bruno replied, remembering something that he'd overheard Father discussing with Grandfather on any number of occasions.
"We're superior."
Shmuel stared at him but didn't say anything, and Bruno felt a strong desire to change the subject because, even as he had said the words, they didn't sound quite right to him, and the last thing he wanted was for Shmuel to think that he was being unkind.
"Where is Poland, anyway?"
he asked after a few silent moments had passed.
"Well, it's in Europe," said Shmuel.
Bruno tried to remember the countries he'd been taught about in his most recent geography class with Herr List.
"Have you ever heard of Denmark?" he asked.
"No," said Shmuel.
"I think Poland is in Denmark," said Bruno, growing more confused, even though he was trying to sound clever, "because that's many miles away," he repeated for added confirmation.
Shmuel stared at him for a moment and opened his mouth and closed it twice, as if he was considering his words carefully.
"But this is Poland," he said finally.
"Is it?"
asked Bruno. "Yes, it is. And Denmark's quite far away from both Poland and Germany."
Bruno frowned. He'd heard of all these places, but he always found it hard to get them straight in his head.
"Well, yes," he said. "But it's all relative, isn't it? Distance, I mean."
He wished they could get off the subject, as he was starting to think he was entirely wrong, and made a private resolution to pay more attention in future in geography class.
"I've never been to Berlin," said Shmuel.
"And I don't think I've ever been to Poland before I came here," said Bruno, which was true because he hadn't. "That is, if this really is Poland."
"I'm sure it is," said Shmuel quietly, "although it's not a very nice part of it."
"No.
Where I come from is a lot nicer."
"It's certainly not as nice as Berlin," said Bruno. "In Berlin, we had a big house with 5 floors, if you counted the basement and the little room at the top with the window. And there were lovely streets and shops and fruit and vegetable stalls and any number of cafes. But if you ever go there, I wouldn't recommend walking around town on a Saturday afternoon, because there are far too many people there then, and you get pushed from pillar to post. And it was much nicer before things changed."
"How do you mean?" asked Shmuel.
"Well, it used to be very quiet there," explained Bruno, who didn't like to talk about how things had changed. "And I was able to read in bed at night. But now it's quite noisy sometimes, and scary. And we have to turn all the lights off when it starts to get dark."
"Where I come from is much nicer than Berlin," said Shmuel, who had never been to Berlin. "Everyone there is very friendly, and we have lots of people in our family, and the food is a lot better, too."
"Well, we'll have to agree to disagree," said Bruno, who didn't want to fight with his new friend.
"All right," said Shmuel.
"Do you like exploring?" asked Bruno after a moment.
"I've never really done any," admitted Shmuel.
"I'm going to be an explorer when I grow up," said Bruno, nodding his head quickly. "At the moment, I can't do very much more than read about explorers. But at least that means that when I'm one myself, I won't make the mistakes they did."
Shmuel frowned.
"What kind of mistakes?" he asked.
"Oh, countless ones," explained Bruno. "The thing about exploring is that you have to know whether the thing you found is worth finding. Some things are just sitting there, minding their own business, waiting to be discovered. Like America. and other things are probably better off left alone, like a dead mouse at the back of a cupboard.
I think I belong to the first category, said Shmuel.
Yes, replied Bruno. I think you do.
Can I ask you something? He added after a moment.
Yes, said Shmuel.
Bruno thought about it. He wanted to phrase the question just right. Why are there so many people on that side of the fence? He asked. And what are you all doing there?
Chapter 11 The Fury. Some months earlier, just after Father received the new uniform, which meant that everyone had to call him Commandant, and just before Bruno came home to find Maria packing up his things, Father came home one evening in a state of great excitement, which was terribly unlike him, and marched into the living room where Mother, Bruno, and Gretel were sitting reading their books.
Thursday night, he announced. If we've any plans for Thursday night, we have to cancel them.
You can change your plans if you want to, said Mother, but I've made arrangements to go to the theatre with—
The Fury has something he wants to discuss with me, said Father,
who was allowed to interrupt Mother even if no one else was.
I just got a phone call this afternoon. The only time he can make it is Thursday evening, and he's invited himself to dinner.
Mother's eyes opened wide, and her mouth made the shape of an O. Bruno stared at her and wondered whether this was what he looked like when he was surprised about something. "But you're not serious," said Mother, growing a little pale. "He's coming here? To our house?" Father nodded.
"At 7 o'clock," he said. "So we better think about something special for dinner."
"Oh, my," said Mother, her eyes moving back and forth quickly as she started to think of all the things that needed doing.
"Who's the Fury?" asked Bruno.
"You're pronouncing it wrong," said Father, pronouncing it correctly for him.
"The Fury," said Bruno again, trying to get it right, but failing again.
"No," said Father, "the—" "No, never mind."
"Well, who is he anyway?" asked Bruno again.
Father stared at him astonished.
"You know perfectly well who the Fury is," he said.
"I don't," said Bruno.
"He runs the country, idiot,"
said Gretel, showing off as sisters tend to do. It was things like this that made her such a hopeless case.
"Didn't you ever read a newspaper?"
"Don't call your brother an idiot, please," said Mother.
"Can I call him stupid?"
"I'd rather you didn't." Gretel sat down again disappointed, but stuck her tongue out of Bruno nonetheless.
"Is he coming alone?" asked Mother.
"I forgot to ask," said Father. "But I presume he'll be bringing her with him."
"Oh, my," said Mother again, standing up and counting in her head the number of things she had to organize before Thursday, which was only 2 evenings away. The house would have to be cleaned from top to bottom, the windows washed, the dining room table stained and varnished, the food ordered, the maids and butlers' uniforms washed and pressed, and the crockery and glasses polished until they sparkled. Somehow, despite the fact that the list seemed to grow longer and longer all the time, Mother managed to get everything finished on time, although she commented over and over again that the evening would be a greater success if some people helped out a little bit more around the house. An hour before the Fury was due to arrive, Gretel and Bruno were brought downstairs, where they received a rare invitation into Father's office. Gretel was wearing a white dress and knee socks, and her hair had been twisted into corkscrew curls. Bruno was wearing a pair of dark brown shorts, a plain white shirt, and a dark brown tie. He had a new pair of shoes for the occasion, and was very proud of them, even though they were too small for him, and were pinching his feet, and making it difficult for him to walk. All these preparations and fine clothes seemed a little extravagant all the same, because Bruno and Gretel weren't even invited to dinner. They had eaten an hour earlier.
"Now, children,"
said Father, sitting behind his desk, and looking from his son to his daughter and back again as they stood before him.
"You know that there is a very special evening ahead of us, don't you?"
They nodded.
"And that it is very important for my career that tonight goes well?"
They nodded again.
"Then there are a number of ground rules which need to be set down before we begin."
Father was a big believer in ground rules.
Whenever there was a special or important occasion in the house, more of them were created.
Number one, said Father, when the Fury arrives, you will stand in the hall quietly and prepare to greet him. You do not speak until he speaks to you, and then you reply in a clear tone, enunciating each word precisely. Is that understood?
Yes, Father, mumbled Bruno.
That's exactly the type of thing we don't want, said Father, referring to the mumbling. You open your mouth and speak like an adult. The last thing we need is for either of you to start behaving like children. If the Fury ignores you, then you do not say anything either, but look directly ahead and show him the respect and courtesy that such a great leader deserves.
Of course, Father, said Gretel in a very clear voice.
And when Mother and I are at dinner with the Fury, you are both to remain in your rooms very quietly. There is to be no running around, no sliding down banisters, and here he looked very deliberately at Bruno, and no interrupting us. Is that understood? I don't want either of you causing chaos.
Bruno and Gretel nodded, and Father stood up to indicate that this meeting was at an end.
Then the ground rules are established, he said.
3/4 of an hour later, the doorbell rang, and the house erupted in excitement. Bruno and Gretel took their places standing side by side by the staircase, and Mother waited beside them, wringing her hands together nervously. Father gave them all a quick glance and nodded, looking pleased by what he saw, and then opened the door. 2 people stood outside, a rather small man and a taller woman. Father saluted them and ushered them inside, where Maria, her head bowed even lower than usual, took their coats and the introductions were made. They spoke to Mother first, which gave Bruno an opportunity to stare at their guests and decide for himself whether they deserved all the fuss being made of them. The Fury was far shorter than Father and not, Bruno supposed, quite as strong. He had dark hair, which was cut quite short, and a tiny moustache. So tiny, in fact, that Bruno wondered why he bothered with it at all, or whether he had simply forgotten the piece when he was shaving. The woman standing beside him, however, was quite the most beautiful woman he had ever seen in his life. She had blonde hair and very red lips. And while the Fury spoke to Mother, she turned and looked at Bruno and smiled, making him go red with embarrassment.
"And these are my children, Fury," said Father, as Gretel and Bruno stepped forward. "Gretel and Bruno." "And which is which?" the Fury said, which made everyone laugh, except for Bruno, who thought it was perfectly obvious which was which and hardly cause for a joke.
The Fury stretched out his hand and shook theirs, and Gretel gave a careful, rehearsed curtsy. Bruno was delighted when it went wrong, and she almost fell over.
"What charming children," said the beautiful blonde woman. "And how old are they, might I ask?" "I'm 12, but he's only 9, said Gretel, looking at her brother with disdain. "And I can speak French too," she added.
Which was not strictly speaking true, although she had learned a few phrases in school.
"Yes, but why would you want to?" asked the Fury.
And this time no one laughed. Instead they shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot, and Gretel stared at him, unsure whether he wanted an answer or not. The matter was resolved quickly, however, as the Fury, who was the rudest guest Bruno had ever witnessed, turned round and walked directly into the dining room and promptly sat down at the head of the table, in Father's seat, without another word. A little flustered, Mother and Father followed him inside, and Mother gave instructions to Lars that he could start heating up the soup.
"I can speak French too," said the beautiful blonde woman, leaning down and smiling at the 2 children. She didn't seem to be as frightened of the Fury as Mother and Father were. "French is a beautiful language, and you are very clever to be learning it."
"Eva!"
shouted the Fury from the other room, clicking his fingers, as if she were some sort of puppy dog. The woman rolled her eyes and stood up slowly and turned round. "I like your shoes, Bruno, but they look a little tight on you," she added with a smile. "If they are, you should tell your mother before they cause you to injure yourself." "They are a little tight," admitted Bruno.
"I don't normally wear my hair in curls," said Gretel, jealous at the attention that her brother was getting.
But why not? Asked the woman. It's so pretty that way.
Eva!
Roared the Fury for a second time, and now she started to walk away from them. It was lovely to meet you both, she said, before stepping into the dining room and sitting down on the Fury's left-hand side. Gretel walked towards the stairs, but Bruno stayed rooted to the ground, watching the blonde woman until she caught his eye again and waved at him, just as Father appeared and closed the doors with a jerk of his head, from which Bruno understood that it was time to go to his room, to sit quietly, and not to make any noise, and certainly not to slide down any banisters. The Fury and Eva stayed for the best part of 2 hours, and neither Gretel nor Bruno were invited downstairs to say goodbye to them. Bruno watched them leave from his bedroom window, and noticed that when they stepped towards their car, which he was impressed to see had a chauffeur, the Fury did not open the door for his companion, but instead climbed in and started reading a newspaper, while she said goodbye once again to Mother and thanked her for the lovely dinner. What a horrible man, thought Bruno. Later that night, Bruno overheard snippets of Mother and Father's conversation. Certain phrases drifted through the keyhole, or under the door of Father's office, and up the staircase, and round the landing, and under the door of Bruno's bedroom. Their voices were unusually loud, and Bruno could only make out a few fragments of them. "To leave Berlin? And for such a place!" Mother was saying.
"No choice. At least not if we want to continue," said Father.
"As if it's the most natural thing in the world, and it's not. It's just not," said Mother.
"What would happen is, I would be taken away and treated like a..."
said Father.
"Expects them to grow up in a place like..." said Mother.
"And that's an end to the matter. I don't want to hear another word on the subject," said Father.
That must have been the end of the conversation, because Mother left Father's office then and Bruno fell asleep. A couple of days later he came home from school to find Maria standing in his bedroom, pulling all his belongings out of the wardrobe and packing them in 4 large wooden crates, even the things he'd hidden at the back that belonged to him and were nobody else's business. And that is where the story began. Chapter 12. Shmuel thinks of an answer to Bruno's question. "All I know is this," began Shmuel. "Before we came here, I lived with my mother and father and my brother Yosef in a small flat above the store where Papa makes his watches. Every morning we ate our breakfast together at 7 o'clock, and while we went to school, Papa mended the watches that people brought to him and made new ones, too. I had a beautiful watch that he gave me, but I don't have it anymore. It had a golden face, and I wound it up every night before I went to sleep, and it always told the right time."
"What happened to it?" asked Bruno.
"They took it from me," said Shmuel.
"Who?"
"The soldiers, of course," said Shmuel, as if this was the most obvious thing in the world. "And then one day things started to change," he continued. "I came home from school and my mother was making armbands for us from a special cloth and drawing a star on each one, like this." Using his finger, he drew a design on the dusty ground beneath him. "And every time we left the house, she told us we had to wear one of these armbands." "My father wears one too," said Bruno, "on his uniform. It's very nice. It's bright red with a black and white design on it." Using his finger, he drew another design in the dusty ground on his side of the fence.
"Yes, but they're different, aren't they?" said Shmuel.
"No one's ever given me an armband," said Bruno.
"But I never asked to wear one," said Shmuel.
"All the same," said Bruno, "I think I'd quite like one. I don't know which one I'd prefer, though, your one or father's."
Shmuel shook his head and continued with his story. He didn't often think about these things any more, because remembering his old life above the watch shop made him very sad.
"We wore the armbands for a few months," he said, "and then things changed again. I came home one day, and Mama said we couldn't live in our house anymore."
"That
"Happened to me too," shouted Bruno, delighted that he wasn't the only boy who'd been forced to move. "The Fury came for dinner, you see, and the next thing I knew we moved here, and I hate it here," he added in a loud voice. "Did he come to your house and do the same thing?"
"No, but when we were told we couldn't live in our house, we had to move to a different part of Krakow, where the soldiers built a big wall, and my mother and father and my brother and I all had to live in one room."
"All of you?" asked Bruno. "In one room?"
"And not just us," said Shmuel. "There was another family there, and the mother and father were always fighting with each other, and one of the sons was bigger than me, and he hit me even when I did nothing wrong."
"You can't have all lived in the one room," said Bruno, shaking his head. "That doesn't make any sense."
"All of us," said Shmuel, nodding his head. 11 in total."
Bruno opened his mouth to contradict him again. He didn't really believe that 11 people could live in the same room together, but changed his mind.
"We lived there for some more months," continued Shmuel, "all of us in that one room. There was one small window in it, but I didn't like to look out of it because then I would see the wall, and I hated the wall because our real home was on the other side of it. And this part of town was the bad part because it was always noisy and it was impossible to sleep. And I hated Luca, who was the boy who kept hitting me, even when I did nothing wrong."
"Gretel hits me sometimes," said Bruno. "She's my sister," he added, "and a hopeless case. But soon I'll be bigger and stronger than she is, and she won't know what's hit her then."
"Then one day the soldiers all came with huge trucks," continued Shmuel, who didn't seem all that interested in Gretel, "and everyone was told to leave the houses. Lots of people didn't want to, and they hid wherever they could find a place. But in the end, I think they caught everyone. And the trucks took us to a train, and the train..." He hesitated for a moment and bit his lip. Bruno thought he was going to start crying and couldn't understand why. "The train was horrible," said Shmuel. "There were too many of us in the carriages, for one thing, and there was no air to breathe, and it smelled awful."
"That's because you all crowded onto one train," said Bruno, remembering the two trains he had seen at the station when he left Berlin. "When we came here, there was another one on the other side of the platform, but no one seemed to see it. That was the one we got. You should have got on it too."
"I don't think we would have been allowed," said Shmuel, shaking his head. "We weren't able to get out of our carriage."
"The doors are at the end," explained Bruno.
"There weren't any doors," said Shmuel.
"Of course there were doors," said Bruno with a sigh. "They're at the end," he repeated, "just past the buffet section."
"There weren't any doors," insisted Shmuel. "If there had been, we would all have got off."
Bruno mumbled something under his breath along the lines of course there were. But he didn't say it very loud, so Shmuel didn't hear.
"When the train finally stopped," continued Shmuel, "we were in a very cold place, and we all had to walk here."
"We had a car," said Bruno out loud now.
"And Mama was taken away from us. And Papa and Yosef and I were put into the huts over there, and that's where we've been ever since."
Shmuel looked very sad when he told this story, and Bruno didn't know why. It didn't seem like such a terrible thing to him, and after all, much the same thing had happened to him.
"Are there many other boys over there?" asked Bruno.
"Hundreds," said Shmuel.
Bruno's eyes opened wide. "Hundreds," he said, amazed. "That's not fair at all. There's no one to play with on this side of the fence, not a single person."
"We don't play," said Shmuel.
"Don't play? Why ever not?"
"What would we play?" he asked, his face looking confused at the idea of it.
"Well, I don't know," said Bruno. "All sorts of things. Football, for example. Or exploration. What's the exploration like over there, anyway? Any good?"
Shmuel shook his head and didn't answer. He looked back towards the huts and turned back to Bruno then. He didn't want to ask the next question, but the pains in his stomach made him.
"You don't have any food on you, do you?" he asked.
"Afraid not," said Bruno.
I meant to bring some chocolate, but I forgot.
Chocolate, said Shmuel very slowly, his tongue moving out from behind his teeth. I've only ever had chocolate once.
Only once? I love chocolate. I can't get enough of it, although Mother says it'll rot my teeth.
You don't have any bread, do you?
Bruno shook his head.
Nothing at all, he said.
Dinner isn't served until 6:30. What time do you have yours?
Shmuel shrugged his shoulders and pulled himself to his feet. I think I'd better get back, he said.
Perhaps you can come to dinner with us one evening, said Bruno,
although he wasn't sure it was a very good idea. Perhaps, said Shmuel, although he didn't sound convinced.
Or I could come to you, said Bruno. Perhaps I could come and meet your friends, he added hopefully.
He had hoped that Shmuel would suggest this himself, but there didn't seem to be any sign of that.
You're on the wrong side of the fence, though, said Shmuel. I could crawl under, said Bruno, reaching down and lifting the wire off the ground. In the center, between the wooden telegraph poles, it lifted quite easily, and a boy as small as Bruno could easily fit through.
Shmuel watched him do this and backed away nervously.
I have to go back, he said. Some other afternoon, then, said Bruno. I'm not supposed to be here. If they catch me, I'll be in trouble.
He turned and walked away, and Bruno noticed again just how small and skinny his new friend was. He didn't say anything about this, because he knew only too well how unpleasant it was being criticized for something as silly as your height, and the last thing he wanted to do was be unkind to Shmuel.
"I'll come back tomorrow," shouted Bruno to the departing boy, and Shmuel said nothing in reply.
In fact, he started to run off back to the camp, leaving Bruno all on his own.
Bruno decided that that was more than enough exploration for one day, and he set off home, excited about what had happened, and wanting nothing more than to tell Mother and Father and Gretel, who would be so jealous that she might just explode, and Maria and Cook and Lars, all about his adventure that afternoon, and his new friend with the funny name, and the fact that they had the same birthday.
But the closer he got to his own house, the more he started to think that that might not be a good idea. After all, he reasoned, they might not want me to be friends with him any more, and if that happens, they might stop me coming out here at all. By the time he went through his front door and smelled the beef that was roasting in the oven for dinner, he had decided that it was better to keep the whole story to himself for the moment, and not breathe a word about it.
It would be his own secret.
Well, his and Shmuel's. Bruno was of the opinion that when it came to parents, and especially when it came to sisters, what they didn't know couldn't hurt them. Chapter 13. The Bottle of Wine. As week followed week, it started to become clear to Bruno that he would not be going home to Berlin in the foreseeable future, and that he could forget about sliding down the banisters in his comfortable home or seeing Carl or Daniel or Martin any time soon. However, with each day that passed, he began to get used to being at Outwith and stopped feeling quite so unhappy about his new life. After all, it wasn't as if he had nobody to talk to anymore. Every afternoon when classes were finished, Bruno took the long walk along the fence and sat and talked with his new friend, Shmuel, until it was time to come home, and that had started to make up for all the times he had missed Berlin. One afternoon, as he was filling his pockets with some bread and cheese from the kitchen fridge to take with him, Maria came in and stopped when she saw what he was doing.
"Hello," said Bruno, trying to appear as casual as possible. "You gave me a fright. I didn't hear you coming."
"You're not eating again, surely?" asked Maria with a smile. "You had lunch, didn't you? And you're still hungry?"
"A little," said Bruno. "I'm going for a walk, and I thought I might get peckish on the way."
Maria shrugged her shoulders and went over to the cooker, where she put a pan of water on to boil. Laid out on the surface beside it was a pile of potatoes and carrots ready for peeling when Pavel arrived later in the afternoon. Bruno was about to leave when the food caught his eye, and a question came into his mind that had been bothering him for some time. He hadn't been able to think of anyone to ask before, but this seemed like a perfect moment and the perfect person.
"Maria," he said,
Can I ask you a question?
The maid turned round and looked at him in surprise.
Of course, Master Bruno, she said.
And if I ask you this question, will you promise not to tell anyone that I asked it?
She narrowed her eyes suspiciously but nodded.
All right, she said. What is it you want to know?
It's about Pavel, said Bruno. You know him, don't you? The man who comes and peels the vegetables and then waits on us at table.
Oh, yes, said Maria with a smile. She sounded relieved that his question wasn't going to be about anything more serious. I know Pavel. We've spoken on many occasions. Why do you ask about him?
Well, said Bruno, choosing his words quite carefully in case he said something he shouldn't. Do you remember soon after we got here when I made the swing on the oak tree and fell and cut my knee?
Yes, said Maria.
It's not hurting you again, is it?
No, it's not that, said Bruno. But when I hurt it, Pavel was the only grown-up around, and he brought me in here and cleaned it and washed it and put the green ointment on it, which stung, but I suppose it made it better, and then he put a bandage on it.
That's what anyone would do if someone's hurt, said Maria.
I know, he continued. Only he told me then that he wasn't really a waiter at all.
Maria's face froze a little, and she didn't say anything for a moment. Instead, she looked away and licked her lips a little before nodding her head.
I see, she said. And what did he say he was, really?
He said he was a doctor, said Bruno, which didn't seem right at all. He's not a doctor, is he?
No, said Maria, shaking her head. No, he's not a doctor. He's a waiter.
I knew it, said Bruno, feeling very pleased with himself. Why did he lie to me, then? It doesn't make any sense.
Pavel is not a doctor any more, Bruno, said Maria quietly.
But he was, in another life, before he came here.
Bruno frowned and thought about it.
I don't understand, he said.
Few of us do, said Maria.
But if he was a doctor, why isn't he one still?
Maria sighed and looked out of the window to make sure that no one was coming, then nodded towards the chairs, and both she and Bruno sat down.
If I tell you what Pavel told me about his life, she said, you mustn't tell anyone. Do you understand? We would all get in terrible trouble.
I won't tell anyone, said Bruno, who loved to hear secrets and almost never spread them around, except when it was totally necessary, of course, and there was nothing he could do about it.
All right, said Maria. This is as much as I know.
Bruno was late arriving at the place in the fence where he met Shmuel every day, but as usual his new friend was sitting cross-legged on the ground waiting for him.
I'm sorry I'm late, he said, handing some of the bread and cheese through the wire, the bits that he hadn't already eaten on the way when he'd grown a little peckish after all.
I was talking to Maria.
"Who's Maria?" asked Shmuel, not looking up as he gobbled down the food hungrily.
"She's our maid," explained Bruno. "She's very nice, although Father says she's overpaid. But she was telling me about this man Pavel who chops our vegetables for us and waits on table. I think he lives on your side of the fence."
Shmuel looked up for a moment and stopped eating.
"On my side?" he asked.
"Yes, do you know him? He's very old and has a white jacket that he wears when he's serving dinner. You've probably seen him."
No, said Shmuel, shaking his head. I don't know him.
But you must, said Bruno irritably, as if Shmuel were being deliberately difficult. He's not as tall as some adults, and he has grey hair and stoops over a little.
I don't think you realize just how many people live on this side of the fence, said Shmuel. There are thousands of us.
But this one's name is Pavel, insisted Bruno. When I fell off my swing, he cleaned out the cut so it didn't get infected and put a bandage on my leg. Anyway, the reason I wanted to tell you about him is because he's from Poland too, like you.
Most of us here are from Poland, said Shmuel, although there are some from other places too, like Czechoslovakia, and...
Yes, but that's why I thought you might know him. Anyway, he was a doctor in his hometown before he came here, but he's not allowed to be a doctor anymore, and if Father had known that he cleaned my knee when I hurt myself, then there would have been trouble.
The soldiers don't normally like people getting better, said Shmuel, swallowing the last piece of bread. It usually works the other way round.
Bruno nodded, even though he didn't quite know what Shmuel meant, and gazed up into the sky. After a few moments, he looked through the wire and asked another question that had been preying on his mind. "You know what you want to be when you grow up?" he asked.
"Yes," said Shmuel. "I want to work in a zoo."
"A zoo?" asked Bruno.
"I like animals," said Shmuel quietly.
"I'm going to be a soldier," said Bruno in a determined voice. "Like father."
"I wouldn't like to be a soldier," said Shmuel.
"I don't mean one like Lieutenant Kotler," said Bruno quickly. "Not one who strides around as if he owns the place and laughs with your sister and whispers with your mother. I don't think he's a good soldier at all. I mean one like father, one of the good soldiers."
"There aren't any good soldiers," said Shmuel.
"Of course there are," said Bruno.
"Who?"
"Well, father, for one," said Bruno. "That's why he has such an impressive uniform, and why everyone calls him Commandant and does whatever he says. The Fuhrer has big things in mind for him because he's such a good soldier."
"There aren't any good soldiers," repeated Shmuel.
"Except father," repeated Bruno, who was hoping that Shmuel wouldn't say that again because he didn't want to have to argue with him. After all, he was the only friend he had here at Outwith. But father was father, and Bruno didn't think it was right for someone to say something bad about him.
Both boys stayed very quiet for a few minutes, neither one wanting to say anything he might regret. "You don't know what it's like here," said Shmuel eventually in a low voice, his words barely carrying across to Bruno.
"You don't have any sisters, do you?" asked Bruno quickly, pretending he hadn't heard that because then he wouldn't have to answer.
"No," said Shmuel, shaking his head.
"You're lucky," said Bruno. "Gretel's only 12, and she thinks she knows everything, but she's a hopeless case, really. She sits looking out of her window, and when she sees Lieutenant Kotler coming, she runs downstairs into the hallway and pretends that she was there all along. The other day, I caught her doing it, and when he came in, she jumped and said, 'Why, Lieutenant Kotler, I didn't know you were here.' And I know for a fact that she was waiting for him."
Bruno hadn't been looking at Shmuel as he said all that, but when he looked again, he noticed that his friend had grown even more pale than usual.
"What's wrong?"
he asked. "You look as if you're about to be sick." "I don't like talking about him," said Shmuel.
"About who?"
asked Bruno.
"Lieutenant Kotler. He scares me."
"He scares me too, a little," admitted Bruno. "He's a bully. And he smells funny. It's all that cologne he puts on." And then Shmuel started to shiver slightly, and Bruno looked around as if he could see rather than feel whether it was cold or not.
"What's the matter?" he asked. "It's not that cold, is it? You should have brought a jumper, you know. The evenings are getting chillier."
Later that evening, Bruno was disappointed to find that Lieutenant Kotler was joining him, mother, father and Gretel, for dinner. Pavel was wearing his white jacket as usual and served them as they ate. Bruno watched Pavel as he went around the table and found that he felt sad whenever he looked at him. He wondered whether the white jacket he wore as a waiter was the same as the white jacket he had worn before as a doctor. As he brought the plates in and set them down in front of each of them, and while they ate their food and talked, he stepped back towards the wall and held himself perfectly still, neither looking ahead nor not. It was as if his body had gone to sleep standing up and with his eyes open. Whenever anyone needed anything, Pavel would bring it immediately. But the more Bruno watched him, the more he was sure the catastrophe was going to strike. He seemed to grow smaller and smaller each week, if such a thing were possible, and the colour that should have been in his cheeks had drained almost entirely away. His eyes appeared heavy with tears, and Bruno thought that one good blink might bring on a torrent.